This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guests are Terrence Howard, the star of the film Hustle and Flow, and Craig Brewer, the writer and director of the film. It's just come out on DVD. Hustle and Flow was Brewer's first theatrical release. The Washington Post described it as a breathtaking national debut, and it won the Audience Award at the 2005 Sundance Film Festival. Actor Terrence Howard received a Golden Globe Best Actor nomination for his work in the film. His other films include Crash, Four Brothers, Ray, Heart's War, and Get Rich or Die Tryin'. Terry spoke with Terrence Howard and Craig Brewer last summer when Hustle and Flow was released. Howard plays DJ, a small-time pimp in Memphis whose dream is to become a rapper. With the help of a friend who records music for a local church, he makes a demo cassette. His plan is to give the cassette to rap star Skinny Black when Skinny Black returns for a visit to Memphis, his hometown. In this scene, after Skinny Black's return, DJ manages to get him the cassette. Skinny Black is played by the real rap star Ludacris.
I got this thing right here. Fucking heartbeats in this thing.
I'm gonna do it with a cassette tape, man.
See, that's my blood pumping, man.
Dog, do you know it's a new millennium? I can't do nothing with no cassette tape. I don't even have a cassette tape player.
Yeah, I appreciate the fact you talking to me, man. Man like this, you know, treat me like an equal, man. And the only reason I give you that right there is because, you know, if you give me a shot, you know, just give me a chance to get my voice heard, man. You know, I wouldn't even have words today, man.
Terrence Howard, Craig Brewer, welcome to Fresh Air. Craig Brewer, when you were trying to get the film produced, how did you describe it? What was the description you used to potential backers?
Well, I described it as this street-hustling pimp who wants to make a recording studio out of the back of his shotgun house. And I know that a lot of the studios, you know, they immediately kind of saw the more sensational elements to the story, you know, such as, like, you know, the fact that the character's a pimp and that he wanted to do rap music. But I kept on trying to reiterate to them all that I really wanted to do a movie about collaboration and creativity. And they do this odd thing in Hollywood where they ask you to they do this thing called running numbers. And what running numbers means is that they ask you to come up with a movie that your movie is comparable to or similar to, and they then find out how much money they spent that movie spent on advertising and how much they spent making it and how much it made, and so then they can kind of, you know, have a better definition as to how they would make that movie or even if they would make that movie. And the problem was is that they were always asking me what my movie was going to be like, and every time I brought up the one movie that I felt was the closest thing to it, which was The Commitments. And I don't know if you've ever seen that movie, but it was Irish kids in trying to make soul music, and you'd see the whole process of them trying to make this music. But I learned very quickly, and it was kind of a little bit disconcerting and heartbreaking, that I could not use that as an example because there were no African Americans in The Commitments. And so I was kind of limited to movies that had predominantly African American casts, which made the movie kind of difficult, because as much as people thought that this was going to be kind of like your standard urban flick where you have pimps and prostitutes and rap music, that's actually not the kind of movie that Terrence and I wanted to make.
Craig, I read that before you made the movie, you were actually approached by a pimp in a car, kind of the same type of thing that that DJ does in the movie, because he has this like battered car that he drives around with one of his prostitutes in. So I'd really like to hear the rap that was laid on you.
Well, what it was is that I was over on this street called Summer Avenue in Memphis, and I was trying to, you know, I was making this movie on digital video called The Poor and Hungry, and I needed just one hotel room at kind of like this, you know, divey hotel. And I knew that they rented by the hour, because that's what the police reports were saying about the place, because it looked like, you know, it was a place where, you know, prostitutes frequented. So I went in to talk to the manager to see if I could pay to film in this hotel room. And I wasn't even doing anything shady. I mean, it was just like this one simple scene. But he wasn't having it. And I just remember pleading with this guy behind the plastic if I could please film there. And he said no. So I'm walking back to my car. And this Chevy Caprice, you know, real beat up kind of car, but it was rolling on, you know, chrome wheels. And and there was this black pimp and a white prostitute, and the white prostitute, she had these micro braids, you know, these little teeny braids, blonde braids into her hair, but she looked so pathetic, just so tired and bored, and he just had this rat-a-tat-tat type of delivery to him, where he was just like, you know, hey man, I saw you leave that hotel. I don't know if you had a good time, but you could take this girl and you can have a good time with her too. You know, it's like you just need like $30, just take her inside there, $20 for the hotel, you know, $50, you can go around the world. You know, he just would not stop. And I'm doing the whole walk towards my car going, no, it's okay. I'm just, you know, and he wouldn't stop. He was like this panther rolling next to me. I mean, like 5 miles an hour, just right on my heel. And the girl just wouldn't say anything, just kind of looked bored, but he would not stop. And I remember getting in my car. And that's when I got to thinking. I was like, what do they talk about all day? Like when they're just rolling around for John's, what is their conversation? What is this man saying to her?
Well, how would you know? How would you know before writing this screenplay?
Well, I mean, you know, the thing about me making movies in Memphis, and especially the movies that I've been making in Memphis, and this is what I love about my city, and it's it really falls into a historical context, is that, you know, the street kind of hustled to help me make my movies. And they knew that I wanted to tell things for real. And so on my first movies, I was filming in chop shops and strip joints, shake joints, and, you know, pistol clubs. And I just got to meet a lot of people. And I think that are good people to sit and talk with and have a beer with and have a conversation with. You know, everybody's talking about the philosophies that DJ spouts in his car. But, you know, I hear this from hustlers. I hear their thoughts on life and about God. And I've always found that to be very interesting. So I took elements of my own life of me trying to deal with the death of my father at an early age and me feeling that my life may be half over if I die at 50 and that, you know, I need to get on with something. But at the same time, you know, you have kind of sins of your own and dark places of your own that you're wrestling with while you're just trying to make one thing pure before you check out. And that's something that a lot of these hustlers felt.
Terry, when you were preparing to play the role, what did you feel like you wanted to know about hustlers?
Well, you know, it's evident the things that they do that's wrong. You know, we all know the difference between right and wrong. But what I wanted to know was, what did you want to do before you got involved with this? You know, what were your dreams before this happened to you? And what went wrong in your life? At what point did you decide that this was your only means of making a living? And they were forthcoming with me.
How did you find the people to talk to?
Well, you know, there's the areas in every city that where generally and sadly it's the urban areas, you know, a lot of disenfranchised people, you know, with nothing left to sell but their pieces of their humanity. And I would go to downtowns, the darker sides of downtowns. You know, you start off talking to a drug dealer who will also know how to tell you where the other side, because part of DJ's life is he was also selling, you know, marijuana. Everything, he was selling everything he could, you know, to hustle. He was shortchanging people. And they would lead me and say, look, I know somebody over here. And then I talked to Craig, and Craig introduced me to some people who were actually involved in this life that were selling weed, you know, pimping, and trying to, you know, get a rap album out. You know, this was real live people. It wasn't just one. It was a number of people. And after 2.5 years of interviewing people, you know, I saw an uncomfortable commonality between me and them.
When you went up to people to talk with them about their lives hustling, did you introduce yourself as Terrence Howard, actor making a movie, or did you pretend like you wanted to buy some time with one of their girls? I mean, what did...
Well, no. Well, fortunately for me, and unfortunately at the same time, the majority of the films that I've been involved with were urban films. And so in these urban environments, all these people, I didn't meet one stranger. Everyone was familiar with me. And so they were a lot more comfortable as far as talking to me openly. And they knew the type of work that I liked to do. They said they were fans of mine. They said I always told the truth about my characters. And I said, well, that opened up the way for me to say, look, well, now a character I'm playing is someone close to your life, you know, and what advice would you have for me as far as finding the truth in this guy?
And so did you go alone or escorted with other people?
No, you know, there's a thing called a ghetto pass. you know, as far as as far as being a black celebrity, you know, I have a ghetto pass, so I could talk to pretty much anybody I want to.
I applied for my card, but it didn't come in yet.
Now that we've tried to look a little bit into the soul of your character, let's look at his hair. you have a quite an incredible hairdo in the movie. It's kind of like conked and curled.
Yeah, well, it's called a process. It's called not a process. It's a perm. It was just
a
strictly a perm that was rolled every day.
I thought you were wearing rollers in the opening scene.
Yeah,
he was. It was curled. I see cats like that all the time in Memphis, just, you know, right there on their porch with their curled hair.
So we talked a long time extensively about how DJ should look. We discussed having a bald head. But I remember a year before we started shooting, Craig said, "Don't cut your hair." He said, "Do not cut your hair. You know, I want to have some options." And so I tried not to. And then we went inside and we permed it right before we were doing the camera test. And
I'll never forget you coming in. I haven't talked about that in a long time, because I remember you coming in and me just thinking, wow, that really works in a really wrong way that totally is right. You know, I'll never forget. Just it was undeniable that we could not have your hair like that after you came in.
Because we thought about cornrows, and Craig was like, "No, that's not it." And John was like, "A bald head," and "No, that's not it." And we thought about a big afro, and "No, that wasn't it." But I talked to a pimp named Tweety Bird in Cleveland. And that was his hair. And he was the one that was the most honest with me, you know. And it wasn't about a stereotype. It was about, you know, it's still a struggle, because black people struggle with, you know, you see everyone having straight hair, or, you know, everyone that you see on television for the most part or advertised before us have this straight hair and they can do anything they want with it. And, you know, as a black person, you're still always trying to fit in as a human being. And so he had went to the extreme of straightening his hair, like Al Sharpton or a number of us do, something we've got to work on.
What was wonderful about it is that, you know, Terrence came in with his hair, and because you would see the process of what it would go through, you then began to see the process that DJ would go through just to get his hair like that. And then it led to scenes that were never in the script, like Suge right before he goes off to the big showdown at the end of the movie, curling his hair. And the beauty in that moment of kind of like her kind of preparing this guy for battle. I you know, you could put a match to my whole film, but just give me that one moment, you know, where Suge is curling his hair. It's beautiful to me. I love it.
Well, you know, in that part of the film, Terry, you're going to meet the character played by Ludacris, who's the
skinny
black, who's like the successful rapper, and you think, if only I could get my cassette to him, I know he'll love it, he'll cut a record, you know, help me cut a record. And so, like, you dress for the occasion, you're wearing like the new leather jacket, and one of the prostitutes gives you this like nameplate medallion that's very old school, among other things, and you look like you're dressed for your first day of rap school. You know,
yeah. Well, yeah. he dressed like Run DMC and
right,
and Kool Moe Dee.
But everything's
so
like
guys.
New and shiny and not lived in.
But Craig told me, you know, DJ wasn't a great rapper. He reassured me with that, mm-hmm. and said that DJ was very uncomfortable with that world. You know, he didn't even know what a hook was to a song. He was very ignorant to the world he was trying to get in, but his desire to survive there was great. And I think that led to so much beauty. And people just seemed to I was so attracted and felt so sorry for him for the most part, because I could see this man just trying. He was just trying.
In one of the main raps in the movie, I mean, the premise is that you're coming in with your, Terrence, you're coming in with your notebook, in which you've written down all these raps, and you're basically reading them in the first recordings that you make. And then, you know, and then the people in who you're working with come up with hooks behind you. And one of the hooks is, you know, it's a hard life for a pimp making money just to try to pay his rent or something like that. And it's both really catchy but almost funny at the same time, because it's like, have empathy for the pimp who's working hard just to try to pay the rent. And, you know, you don't,
right. It's hard out
you know, you don't think of yourself as like, man, those pimps, they really have it hard. You think of them as exploiting people. Do you know what I mean? And not as like, boy, it's really tough being pimp paying the rent. So I thought that you wanted to, you look like you want to say something.
Well, no, that's what I was saying. You know, DJ, one of the things that I like, when Craig first told me about the movie and I decided I was going to try and do it, and that's, I have to say that I was going to try and do it because I didn't know if I was going to be able to. And almost up until 2 weeks before we were going to start shooting, I sat on my wife's bed, edge of my wife's bed, and told her, I don't think I can do this. I don't think I can pull this off. And I was about to call Craig and say, I'm so sorry. But I was like, I put my mind into it. But Craig told me, he said, DJ is not a good pimp. He's not good at it. You know, one of the first rules about pimping is, as far as the real life of pimping, is you can't love the prostitutes. You can't love them. And DJ had true love for them. And I tried to watch all those. Remember those videos I told you I went to see Craig, where, you know, American right. Pimp and all of that. And I was like, which one of these characters is DJ like? And Craig said DJ none is like none of them.
Well, the thing is that, like, one of my favorite scenes in the movie is DJ picking up one of his girls from one of the strip clubs. And they're just walking out to the car. And there's just, it just seems like, you know, they just were working on like an assembly line. You know, it's just like it's she's complaining, her feet hurt. DJ gets in the car, his one prostitute, Nola, fell asleep in the back of the car, and they're all chatting and talking. And it's at this moment where I remember turning to Singleton and saying, you know, we got to film this scene like DJ's a soccer mom, you know, that's like picking up kids from like all these different places and they're fighting. He's like, now, wait, you know, now hang on. Now, just, you know, I want you all to be quiet till we go and get food, and then we're going to go home and we'll watch some TV. But, you know, I need some peace, you know, but that he doesn't have that. And so, you know, I just wanted to make him a little bit, you know, in the kind of vein that an audience would, you know, identify with, at least not selling women, but wow, you know, this day at work really, you know, was awful, and I'm
that's
tired.
That's why it was hard out there for DJ, because if he had been a true pimp, the stereotypical pimp, you know, he would have told him to shut up, smacked them or whatever, and went about, you know, and dominating them. But he allowed them to be human beings that they were struggling together. And that struggle and that conscience, the fact that he still had a conscience, made it hard for him to be in the life in which he was living.
Now, Craig, I read that before you started making Hustle and Flow, that your wife worked as a stripper in Memphis?
Yeah.
And that was not as research for your film, I take it.
No, that was two young people deciding early on to be young and dumb and seeing what kind of life they could experience. And but yeah, I mean, Jody and I, we kind of grew up in the arts, and then, you know, we did theater together. And so when we moved to Memphis, it was obviously this kind of exciting element that we needed some money, and she was going to start off as a cocktail waitress. And then one day she just said, you know, would you have a problem with me dancing a little bit? And I was like, no, I'm fine. But what we found over the, you know, 2 years that she was doing that is that it does wear on you, and it doesn't wear on you in the way of like, oh, there's my wife up there, you know, taking her clothes off, but it wears on you just in terms of the life itself and what a lot of the dancers kind of have to do to desensitize themselves to, you know, these guys who want a fantasy. You know, they don't want reality. They want some sort of fantasy. And it really, it's knowing those girls that Jody worked with and knowing the guys who worked the door, and just, you know, I mean, I would finish my night shift and then I'd have to go to the, I'd go to this bar and I would write screenplays after I finished my night shift, and then I'd have to go pick up Jody at about 3 a.m. And so, you know, whenever that scene I told you about when we're walking out to the car, I always remember, you know, me and my wife just look at each other with a smirk and shake our heads just like, do you remember those times? Do you remember me picking you up with like maybe one other friend and us going to Krispy Kremes at like 2 a.m. in the morning and like shopping at Walmart, you know, at 3 or 4 in the morning. And it's just it's not that great of a life, really, you know, to work in the night, you know, like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm. You play a rapper, somebody who wants to rap and who is starting out and hopefully staying in the world of rap. Have you rapped before the role?
No, I mean, that's just... Craig might tell you guys a story when we were at the Chateau Marmont and we decided we were doing... We just finished auditioning people. And I pulled out my guitar and we played a little bit and had a couple drinks. So everybody was relaxed. And Craig was like, wow, that's great. You know, you should come down. When you're in Memphis, you should go and play in some of the little spots around Memphis, you know, and because it's a whole other side of you that I never even knew existed. And I got so excited. I was like, well, that's what we need to do then. You know, why can't DJ play guitar? Why can't he sing? Why does he have to rap? Why does he... And Craig, you can finish that.
Oh, well, you know what it was is that it was the first time that I had been in the room with Terrence as a director to an actor that it was now going to be in my movie. And it was like the first time that I'm like staring down, like, you know, it's that moment where like the two lions are looking at each other. And Terrence was very passionate, like, I want to play the guitar, you know, I want to do that. And I remember Stephanie looking at me with kind of like these big eyes, like, how are you going to answer this, Craig? And I remember swallowing and saying, well, first of all, the writer director in me of Hustle and Flow says absolutely not. Because, you know, this is a story about a guy who his talent is so raw that he isn't even aware of it, whereas like a guitar is something, you know, and singing, that's something you kind of got to work on. It's a craft. And then I said, but second, Terrence, knowing that this is like your craft and this is something that's good, you don't know what may come of you after this experience. You know, allow yourself to go into this rap world and learn and keep your eyes and ears open. It may inform your artistry to some extent. And I think it did, because the great thing about watching Terrence come into the studio to make these things happen is that he didn't completely yield himself and his essence from the rap. There is a touch of that swagger in Terrence Howard in his rap that when people of my region listen to it, they go, you know, he's really good. And I think what it is that because he found that rhythm and he found that essence of this character and he imbued his rap with that.
Terrence, I really like the way you talk in the movie. You know, for a lot of us who've seen both Crash and Hustle and Flow in a short period of time, you know, almost back to back, your characters are very different, very, very middle class in Crash. You're a television director. You speak very, very well. In Hustle and Flow, you speak very well, but it's a more, first of all, it's a more southern accent. Second of all, there's a little bit of a mumble in it.
The mumble that John Singleton tried to get me to get rid of?
Why?
He was like, you're mumbling. He didn't recognize it as a choice.
Yeah, no, it seemed just right to me, I have to say.
He said, you're mumbling, we don't understand what you're saying. But when I was down there with Craig...
I understood.
Yeah, Craig understood, but most of the guys that you talk to, you have to listen 3 or 4 times, play it back in your head. What did they just say? Because there was this... The cadence had... it was a song-like way of speaking. And you try and catch on to it, and that was a difficult task. I remember Craig really going through the phonics of the entire thing, trying to say, "Well, this is how you say this word
with
and
a Memphis accent."
Yes, uh-huh. And carry this through. And then I had to take that a little further in talking to some of the other guys.
Do you remember the first sentence I told you? Terrence and I were on the phone, and Terry, you can try this too. I said, "Terrence, try to say this." I said, "Say I'm down, but I'm still here." And he said, I'm down, but I'm still here. And I said, okay, but now don't say still, say steal. And don't say here, say her. And so I'm down, but I'm steal her. And if you loosen that up a little bit and you put a mumble to it, it's like, you know, I'm down, but I'm steal her. You know, that sounds Memphis. You know, that's a particular kind of like South Memphis or North Memphis type of accent. And I remember being kind of worried that the audience wouldn't understand what Terrence would be saying or anybody would be saying, including Isaac Hayes, who has that natural accent for the first 20 minutes of the movie. But what ends up happening, which I find really interesting, is everybody adjusts to our rhythm in the South for like the first time in a long time, you know, and people begin to hear the words clearly, but we haven't been clear with our words. The audience has just shifted into our rhythm.
It took months, though. It took a few months to get there.
Let's hear you rapping. And this is something from the movie, and it's called Hard Life for a Pimp. And here we go.
You know it's hard out here for a pimp when he's trying to get his money for the rent. For the Cadillac and gas money spent. You know it's hard out here for a pimp when he's trying to get his money for the rent. For the Cadillac and gas money spent.
In my eyes, I done seen some crazy things in the streets. Got a couple hoes working on the changes for me. But I gotta keep my game tight like Kobe on game night. Like kicking from a hole, don't know no better. I know that ain't right. I've seen people killed. I've seen people killed.
And see, y'all cleaned that up a little bit, huh?
I'll tell you something. It's good you played that because you heard that one little thing in there, that one line, like, taken from a hoe, don't know no better, I know that ain't right. But the way he says it is like, taken from a hoe, don't know no better, I know that ain't right. And that, I mean, that's the prime example of, like, you know, three words becoming one word that you know, Al Capone and Juicy J were doing with Terrence.
Yeah. They really took me through the ringer.
What else did they do to coach you?
I kept trying to sing through stuff, and they was like, no, rappers don't sing. We don't have talent. We just talk. That's all we do is talk. There you go singing again. They take all the melody out of my voice. All the melody out of my voice. They did great. They did great.
I felt really stupid after seeing the movie because that refrain, you know, hard out here for a pimp, is really catchy. And so I'm leaving the theater singing that to myself. I felt like that's really, I sound really stupid singing that.
Yeah. Wait till you see 800 Mormons at Salt Lake City screening for Sundance coming out of theater singing that. You know, you've seen something when you've seen that.
You know, the woman, the prostitute in the movie who's singing backup in that, did you intend her, Craig, to look like a very strung out young Diana Ross?
Wow.
No, but she could be an incredible Diana Ross. I mean, she's really a remarkable actress, and she's really the heart of that movie. I remember telling both Taraji and Taryn about this one moment when I was filming one of my first movies at a strip club where I had a crew of two. It was me holding the camera and my brother-in-law held the microphone. But I needed my brother-in-law to hold the light. And so we needed someone to hold the boom pole, and this one stripper with freckles across her nose just said, you know, I'll hold it. And so for like 3 hours in clear pumps, you know, this girl held this this microphone above her head. And I remember we were packing up and she just came up to me and she was like, are y'all coming back tomorrow? You know, where are you going to be? Can I help? And I remember just thinking like, wow, she just got bit, you know. And we got to remember that there are people, even though that we're not like this at all, there are people who've never been asked their opinion. And there are people who've never been asked to sing or for us to hear what's in their heart. And that's what these characters' journey is. For the first time, Shug is hearing her voice in that context.
Craig, you're white and wrote this movie that is about African-American characters, has a mostly African-American cast. Were you told when you were trying to get the film made that it was going to be less authentic, less real, or less saleable because it wasn't written and directed by an African-American?
Well, no, that's what was kind of messing with people. You know, they would get the script and even some, African-American junior executives were saying, well, you know, thank God, you know, here's, you know, this is a very, you know, realistic portrayal. This is like, you know, a perfect African-American voice. And then I walked in and, you know, it was deer in the headlights. They couldn't really believe I just walked in. But I found that the reason why many people were resistant about it is because it was a personal story. If I were doing something where there was action or a ton of violence or goofy humor, you know, where we were laughing at DJ instead of empathizing with him, then it would be okay for me to direct it because then it's commerce. But as soon as it becomes a personal story and when race is involved and interestingly enough, even on my next movie, gender, that there's a question as to whether or not you can explore that and not be of the race and not be of the gender.
Well, Terrence, if you would, I'm going to ask you to stick around a little longer so we could talk about your career and your life, some of your other movies. And Craig Brewer, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. It's been great. Thank you.
And Craig, thank you again for that enormous opportunity. You said the film would change my life, and it really has. Thank
That's
you.
That's good. We got more to do, brother, you and me.
Terrence Howard, let's talk about your early career. How were you first given your first acting role?
The first role I did was on The Cosby Show. I did one episode on that and didn't
How
understand.
Old were you?
I was 19. I've been trying to act since I was like maybe about 16. I've been really trying. And it took about 2.5, 3 years before somebody would really give me a shot, you know. And I bumped into the casting director of The Cosby Show on the street when I was about 18, 19. And he finally let me come in and read, and they gave me a part.
So that's how you got your first part?
Yeah.
Samuel Jackson used to be the, not he the body the, double, what do you call
no,
it?
No. He was, Samuel Jackson was funny about Sam. Sam was...
On the Cosby Show.
Yes, yeah. No, but he worked in the building. He was a security guard in the building that I lived in.
Oh, you're kidding.
Sam used to let me in and, to my apartment. He was my the security guard at the gate. We lived at a place called Manhattan Plaza on 43rd and 9th Avenue.
Oh, is that where a lot of artists live?
Yes.
Yeah.
And he was...
And musicians.
He was the security guard there.
But I know on the Cosby Show, well, like when they would do lighting instead of Cosby just having to be there for the lighting, Samuel Jackson.
Yeah, he was a stand-in for
him. The stand-in, that's
stand-in
what I'm looking
for. Him, yeah.
So was he doing that when you were...
Yeah, I guess he was. I guess he was... I guess he had made the move over there, but I had known Samuel since I was 8, 9 years old.
Oh,
you
that's
know?
So funny.
It's funny that you brought that up, yeah.
Now your grandmother...
Yeah, Minnie Gentry, my great-grandmother.
Your great-grandmother, she acted in
she
stage?
Was a, yeah, stage actress.
How successful was she?
She, you know, she acted well enough to make a living, but, you know, Manhattan Plaza, they subsidize your rent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if an actor only makes $100 a year, then they only have to pay 10% of their rent.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Your rent for that whole, you know, year was $10, even though it was a great building and still is a great building run and operated for the sake of artists.
So when you were growing up, was your great-grandmother still performing?
Yes. Yes. I mean, she used to bring me to all her rehearsals with her. I spent every summer with her since I was like 3 years old. And when she was rehearsing, she would record everything, all the other actors' lines, you know, and then she would stop the tape and say her lines. And she was doing that one day when I was about 5, and I'd heard the recording so many times that I started saying the other actors' lines, and I had a really good memory back then.
Those were the
what
days.
Happened. And so I guess I had a good 20 years of experience watching her, you know, and working with her.
Let me ask you about something that, let me preface this by saying, this might be too personal. So if it is, you just tell me and I'll move someplace else. I read, and tell me if this is true, that when you were 8, you saw your father stab a man?
Well, no, I was 3. 3 years old. Cleveland is still one of the most racially segregated places on the planet, and my father can pass for white. And, you know, it was December 23rd, 1972, and we're standing in the May Company line, you know, to get in the Santa Claus line. My dad had already been there, and my mom was walking us around getting stuff while my dad was in line. And when we came and got in front of my father, and this white woman behind him said, you know, why you let those niggers cut you? And my dad said, this is my wife. And then this white guy, my dad's like 5'7½", weighed about 120 pounds, and this white guy named Robert E. Fitzgerald, who was about 6'4", weighed about 250. I remember seeing him like a mountain. You know, he was 2 steps away from Santa Claus, and he said, that's the problem. There's too many nigger lovers around here. My daddy said, responded back to him, you know, F you or something. And I remember the guy picking up my daddy and strangling him on top of the table, you know, the display table where this gifts for Santa Claus was, and was just strangling him. And my dad was trying to push him off him, and the guy wouldn't let go. And then all of a sudden, the guy collapsed on my father. And I remember my daddy standing over him saying, please don't die, please don't die. and you know, go to all that stuff. And Daddy went to jail, and because in Cleveland they don't have a self-defense law, you know, he had grabbed a nail file and just to get this huge man off of him. That.
So he stabbed him with a nail file.
Yeah.
And that's what killed him?
Stabbed him. Well, he tried to stick him in the leg, and the guy wouldn't let go, was still choking him. And stuck him 3 times in his leg, and guy wouldn't let go. And then stuck him in the stomach, guy wouldn't let go. And he was just trying to get him off of him, you know, and it punctured his heart. And the guy, you know, finally died. But he was trying to kill my father that day. And it was me and my 3 brothers standing there watching my father get strangled to death. And what was interesting is there were the white man had 3 sons that watched their father die that day.
Wow.
You know, so that was the last time we celebrated Christmas.
So his 3 sons were watching, and you and your brothers were watching?
Yeah.
What was going through your mind as you were watching this?
Get off my daddy. You know, you're watching your father get strangled. You're watching your father get pummeled, you know. He beat my daddy for a while before he started strangling him.
So your father spent how long in prison?
A few years in prison, you know.
Did you visit him there?
Yeah, we tried to, but, you know, but prison changed him. Prison changes most people.
How did it change him?
Well, you become more militant and, you know, you lose faith in the world. You come out, you know, and can't get a job anymore because you're a convicted felon. But the other alternative was him being dead. So I'd rather him be a convicted felon, you know, for trying to save his life than, you know, than to be dead and to be talking about him in a past tense.
So prison changed him. How did the whole thing change you? This is a really formative experience.
You lose your father. Mm-hmm. You just lose your father because he's not the same person anymore, and you lose your means of. My father used to sell insurance, and we had a decent life. You know, when my father went to jail, we were forced to move into the projects and get on welfare. And, you know, being light-skinned, half-black, half-white kids in the middle of an urban jungle, you know, that's racially charged, you know, you got chased home every day and people pop you in the head and say, watch him turn red most of your life, being attacked like that, you know, for most of your childhood. It affected me.
So what was it in your life, in addition to your grandmother, that made you think about the life that you've made for yourself, you know, as an actor?
Well, I remember when I was a kid, I was told, you know, the imagination, anything that you think, you can make happen. And so being in that world and having seen a different world, I would always imagine myself being in that different world, and I would pretend that I was just visiting the projects or visiting that school, and that pretending, you know, ultimately led to me developing a craft called acting, you know, and I believed it. And nowadays it makes sure that my children never have to live in the projects.
Terrence Howard, a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much, and congratulations on all your success.
Thank you, Terry, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to express some of my views.
Oh, my pleasure.
Terrence Howard, star of the film Hustle and Flow, speaking with Terry Gross. Earlier, we heard Craig Brewer, who wrote and directed the film.